Lithwick and Martin White regarding dark matter halos. And sorry, yeah, you know, and so sorry for my cold right now. You know, it's making me sort of loopy, I think. So here's the basic outline of what I was planning to talk about. So what I'll do is to first start out describing some of the basic properties that dark matter halos are found to have in simulations, and maybe also, in the real world. And then I'll try to give a simple way to understand where those basic properties are coming from. At the end, if there's time, then I'll discuss what changes in this basic picture when we have like variations or departures from the normal regular lambda CDN cosmology, if there's time at the end. And these talks are supposed to be like half an hour, so you said, right? Okay, so I probably won't make it. Okay, so first of all, so what are these halos that I'll be talking about? And so hopefully most of you are at least somewhat familiar with dark matter halos. You know, they're a byproduct of nonlinear structure formation. For the purposes of this talk, we can think of halos just simply as being structures that have collapsed in all three dimensions, okay, so X, Y, and Z, that are gravitationally self-bound and that are virialized in some sort of vague sense. And maybe more usefully, you can think of halos just simply as these sort of blobs that all of us have seen in n-body simulations. Now, these halos actually seem to exist in the real universe, all right? You know, so there's now quite compelling evidence for the presence of these sort of halos surrounding galaxies or galaxy groups and galaxy clusters. Some of these lines of evidence range from galaxy rotation curves, which for decades now have shown that the mass profile surrounding galaxies increase with radius well beyond the visible extent of the baryonic component of the galaxies. And tidal streams more recently have also recently provided very interesting constraints on the detailed shapes of halos, or of nearby halos like the Milky Way halo or the Andromeda halo. And of course, gravitational lensing quite recently has provided some truly spectacular measurements of the detailed properties of the halo surrounding galaxies, galaxy groups, and even giant galaxy clusters. Okay, so it's pretty clear now that these halos actually do exist in the real universe. And the properties of these halos are, of course, incredibly important for a wide variety of different problems in astrophysics and cosmology, ranging from galaxy formation and star formation, dark matter annihilation, the clustering of tracers that we can observe like quasars or galaxies. You know. And so all of these properties, all these things are determined in large part by the properties of the underlying dark matter halos. Right? You know, and so it's important for this reason to try to understand in a sort of simple, robust way, where these important properties are coming from. Okay, especially once we start thinking about cosmologies that are somewhat different than our usual regular lambda CDM-like cosmologies. That are maybe somewhat more difficult to simulate. So that's what I'll try to provide in this talk. Okay, you know, a simple way to understand at least some of these basic important properties of halos. And the approach that I'll take for doing this is to start with the assumption that halos are forming from peaks of the initial linear density field laid down at very early times. Okay, and so the basic picture is hopefully familiar to all of you. Okay, so the idea is that that at a very high redshift, some process, maybe inflation, lays down tiny density fluctuations. Okay, and so what we do, just to sort of find the peaks. The peaks of the initial random fluctuations, and those peaks grow over time through gravitational instability into the halos that we're familiar with at late times. Okay, and so then the idea then just is to try to understand the properties of the late time halos in terms of the properties of the peaks that they're coming from. Okay. So the key ingredient in doing this, of course, is to have a simple model to describe this process of the gravitational collapse of peaks into halos. Okay? And so we decided to model this process by studying the collapse of a fairly simple class of initial peaks namely peaks that are initially scale-free in radius. Okay, so scale-free here just means that the initial linear density field is assumed to be some power law with radius, with some power law slope gamma, and some arbitrary initial angular dependence. Okay, and so all we did then just was to study the collapse of this very simple type of peak, and then we tried to apply what we learned for the more general case of gravitational collapse. Right. Okay, so now, so because this class of initial profiles is scale-free, and because relativity is scale-free, and the collapse solutions are guaranteed to be self-similar, which is really, really useful. Okay, so self-similarity is a very commonly used trick in astrophysics, you know, as most of you probably know. So part of the reason why self-similarity is so useful is that self-similarity allows you to reduce the effective dimensionality of the problem you're studying by one. Okay. So for example, in a self-similar calculation, you can achieve higher and higher spatial resolution in the calculation just by running it for a longer and longer time. Okay. So that's one of the main advantages for using this sort of technique. So for the for the calculations that I'll be showing you in a few minutes, so we typically achieve spatial dynamic ranges that are many orders of magnitude larger than what is possible using normal conventional n-body simulations. And we did so using runtimes that are many, many orders of magnitude faster than the requirements for those same normal ordinary n-body simulations. Okay. So first let me just show you quickly some examples of these sort of self-similar calculations that we did. Okay, so for example, this is how spherical collapse looks. Okay, so not terribly interesting is happening here, just the various shells first expand, turn around, and then recollapse into the halo in a spherically symmetric way because of the imposed spherical symmetry. Okay, so nothing terribly exciting is happening here. So non-spherical collapse is somewhat more interesting. Okay, so here, the various different shells turn around and recollapse non-spherically. And so you can see the different axes fall back into the halo at different times. And so the halo settles down into a triaxial configuration, as you can see. So that's the basic model. Okay, and so now what we'll do is to apply this model for collapse to try to understand some of the basic properties that halos are found to have. Okay, so the first property that we'll look at is just a simple property of halo statistics. Okay, so it's basic things like the abundance of halos, how they cluster, that sort of thing. So the first statistic that we'll look at is just the halo mass function, which just means the number of halos, the mean number of halos as a function of halo mass. Okay, so at present, most of our knowledge of the halo mass function is based almost entirely on n-body simulations, okay, and also the fitting functions that are calibrated to match those n-body simulations, okay. You know, so the only real theory that's been used, that's been used in the literature is the Kresh-Schechter model, which is a theory in quotes. So Kresh-Schechter model, the Kresh-Schechter model, is very, very simple and very easy to apply, but it's also not terribly accurate. Okay, so to illustrate that, some examples are shown here. So here are plots of the halo mass function in a couple different regimes. Okay, and the blue curves show the Kresh-Schechter prediction. Okay, and so you can see that at high masses, for example, the Kresh-Schechter model tends to underpredict the number of halos that are formed. By a factor that gets worse and worse towards higher and higher masses. Sorry. Yeah, this is this blue curve. So in the ratio, for example, it's it's falling off the plot. Isn't this blue?
Because there is also a blue curve.
Okay, so this curve. Okay, so at high masses, Kresh-Schechter grossly underpredicts the number of halos that are formed, at factors of 10 easily at the very highest masses. And at low masses, Kresh-Schechter overpredicts the number of halos that are formed. So the basic shape of the mass function is just wrong. Okay. Um, Okay. So there's a fairly easy way to see, to see why Price Checker does so badly. I think, though, in the interest of time, I'll skip through this. Yeah, it's pretty simple. Okay. So instead, what I'll do just to focus on this peaks calculation. Okay. All right. So the basic idea here, is that halos are forming from peaks, right? Okay. So peaks are the initial random linear density field. Okay. And at least for Gaussian random fields, the statistics of those peaks are perfectly well known. Okay. So as long as we know which peaks are making which halos, we can then use those known peak statistics to figure out all possible halo statistics. Okay. And so the key ingredient in doing this is, of course, just having this mapping from peaks to halos, which just means having a simple collapse model. And of course, the collapse model that I'll be using is this simple self-similar collapse model. So the first step, though, just to briefly go over the peak statistics. So as I said, for Gaussian random fields, all these peak statistics, they were all worked out decades ago in the well-known paper BBKS by Bardeen et al., 1986. So in this paper, they provide expressions for all sorts of peak statistics of interest. So for example, they have expressions for things like the number density of peaks as a function of peak height. Okay. And for the experts, so the Price Checker model, roughly speaking, corresponds just to keeping this one piece right here and throwing away everything else. Okay. Which is the reason why it does so badly at high masses. So BBKS tell you things like the number of peaks. They also provide expressions for things like the distribution of peak shapes. Okay, so things like the axis ratios, the triaxiality of the peaks, the distribution of the peak radial profiles, so things like the curvatures, the average radial slopes. Okay, so all these things, they're all worked out decades ago. And so then given the known peak statistics, and given the collapse model, we can then easily compute all possible halo statistics. Okay, so for example, the halo mass function, the number of halos, just simply becomes a simple integral over all possible peak parameters, of the number of of the number of those peaks that are able to make halos of the type that we are counting. Okay, so very simple, very straightforward. So now in principle, the possible number of peak parameters can be enormous. Okay. So these integrals for the halo statistics could become quite difficult to evaluate. Right. And so for simplicity, what we did was to assume that just three parameters in the peaks were important in setting the final halo properties. All right. So we assume that just the average radial slope gamma and two parameters is describing the quadrupole moments in the peak. So we assumed that just these three parameters were important in setting the final halo parameters, the halo properties. Okay. And so then all we did was to map out this simple parameter space just by running large forms of these very cheap calculations. Okay. All right. So let me just quickly show you some of the trends that we find.
So the average, are you talking about?
In the Price Checker way of thinking about things, right? Okay, you're taking the density and smoothing it on some scale, right? So this slope corresponds to the average slope when you smooth on that scale.
With a top hat filter.
With a filter that's close to top hat, you can't actually do exactly top hat because some of the required statistics diverge, but it's something close to a top hat, which is motivated from n-body simulations. Let me just briefly go through some of the basic trends. Triaxiality. The quadrupole moments of the peaks. So basic trend is that increasing the triaxiality tends to delay the formation of halos. Okay. Or in the language of Price Checker, increasing the triaxiality has the effect of increasing the collapse threshold. And that's been well known for a long time. That's the basic reason why Price Checker does so badly at low masses.
This is from your simulation.
Yes, these are the self-similar calculations, yeah. Similarly, the effect of the slopes, the average radial slopes of the peaks, So making the slope steeper and steeper has the basic effect of making the halo masses smaller and smaller in terms of the filter scale. Okay, that's just a sort of that's just a sort of technical detail for the experts. How do you define mass? Yeah. Okay. So that's a good question. Okay. So here, what we've done is to apply a friends of friends mass, right? So if you use some other halo definition like spherical over density or something else, the mass that you'll find here will be somewhat different. But it's very important to apply the same definition of a halo here as you use, in the n-body simulations. So those are some of the basic trends.
Is self-similar.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay, so friends of friends basically corresponds, to defining the halo boundary as an isodensity contour. Okay. So what we did then, just was that, okay? So we set the isodensity contour, to be the appropriate density value corresponding to friends of friends of 0.2 linking length. Which is not actually 125 density. That was sort of surprised, but it's not. So now let me just show you some of the basic results of these calculations. So here, for example, is the halo mass function for a WMAP-like cosmology. All right, so the points with error bars show the results of full cosmological n-body simulations, and the black curve shows this very simple kind of trivial model. Okay, and you can see the model agrees across this range. Right. Now, for comparison, I've also plotted some of the popular fitting functions that are also used in the literature, and you can see that these fitting functions also agree reasonably well, at least for the 15-20% level. It's not surprising, of course, because these fitting functions were designed to match this mass function. So now these fitting functions were, of course, calibrated for those sort of lambda CDM-like cosmologies, right? But because they're just fitting functions, right? So because none of them have any physics in them whatsoever, it's hard to know how to extrapolate those fitting functions for cosmologies that are different than these sort of lambda CDM-like cosmologies that they were calibrated for. Okay, so some examples of that are shown here. Right, so here I'm plotting the halo mass function for some scale-free cosmologies. Okay, so scale-free here just means that omega matter equals one. And the linear power spectrum is taken to be a power law with radius going like k to the n for n equals 0, minus 1, minus 2. Okay, and so you can see that these popular fitting functions don't work across the entire range of power spectra of interest. Okay, so for example, so for n equals 0, these fitting functions can disagree with the full n-body results by easily factors of 10. Okay. And again, not so surprising. Not so surprising, just because these are all just fitting functions with no physics in them whatsoever. Okay. So if you instead try to use a model that is basically partially on physics, like the black curve, then you can see that it's fairly easy to reproduce the full n-body results across the entire range. Okay. So for the experts in the audience. So the reason why this model works across the entire range is that the abundance of peaks has an explicit dependence upon the shape of the power spectrum. Okay, whereas in contrast, these fitting functions, for some reason, these fitting functions, they all make the assumption that the halo mass function is what's called universal in form. Okay, which, as you can see, is not a justified approximation, right? So the basic point just is that it's pretty easy to understand simple statistics like the halo mass function, as long as you use a model that is based at least somewhat on physics.
Right.
Yeah, so we use the distribution of axis ratios for Gaussian and Hill peaks. Worked out by Dick and by George Cavish.
But the relation between mass and praxeology and gamma, that relation is independent of cosmology?
So the various correlations between those parameters depend upon the shape of the power spectrum in a way that's known.
But you did these simulations with, let's have similar simulations.
Right.
They do depend on the cosmology, don't they?
So the calculations were all done for CL3 cosmologies in which omega matter equals 1.
So you have to do a different simulation if you have a different cosmology.
No. So the idea here is to do calculations for the collapse of isolated peaks.
Yes.
And so we're mapping out the possible parameter space for all possible peaks. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the statistics of that space, right? The statistics are determined by the power spectrum. Okay. But that space that we're mapping out doesn't depend upon the background cosmology, except for assuming that it's scale-free.
But it's also the time dependence is different, so I'm just thinking...
So at late times for a lambda CDM like cosmology, once lambda becomes important, that breaks the scale invariance. And so for late times, we can make corrections to the mass function to account for that. Mm-hmm. But it's fairly straightforward to do. So that's the mass function. How are we doing on time?
We've left a lot of discussions.
So we can also understand, things like the clustering of halos, okay? So the quantity that's quoted most commonly to describe halo clustering is a so-called halo bias, which is just defined as the derivative of the number of halos in some region as the background density level is varied up and down. So if you take this definition of the bias, and if you move the denominator over to the left-hand side, you can see that this gives a well-known linear bias model, which just says that the halo over density in some region is just directly proportional to the matter over density in that region, and the constant of proportionality is just the bias, okay? Which is very useful, because on scales for which, the sort of linear bias model is valid, then it becomes very easy to work out all possible halo endpoint statistics in terms of the underlying matter endpoint correlation functions times appropriate powers of the bias. So we use something called the peak background split to compute the biases for our peaks. Okay, and it's fairly straightforward doing this to show that the peak's bias is just simply related to the conditional mean invariance of the density field when you condition upon the type of peak that you're counting. And the halo bias then just becomes a simple average of the peaks bias when you average over the population of peaks, making the halos of the type that you're counting. Okay, so very simple. Okay, here's how that looks in practice. So here is the halo bias at some different regimes. Again, the error bars are simulations. The black curve is our model, and you can see that it agrees across the entire range. No big surprise, even the mass function agreement. So we can also understand, some more subtle properties of the halo clustering. One example is this assembly bias. This might be actually, somewhat too technical though for this audience, so maybe I'll skip through that. But if people have questions, you can ask me about this. Okay, so that was just a very simple warm-up exercise. Okay, so the point of the halo statistics stuff just was to convince you that it's possible to understand interesting properties of halos using these sort of self-similar calculations. And so now we'll try to understand something a bit more complicated, the internal structures of dark matter halos, the halo profiles. So first let me just briefly remind you of how this looks. So for the vast majority of halos, the density profiles in those halos are well described by something like the Navarro-Frank-White profile, shown here. Okay, so all this means just is that at large radii, the halo density falls off very steeply with radius. Okay, and towards smaller and smaller radii, the slope of the density profile very gradually, slowly rolls over. Okay, towards smaller and smaller r. Okay, So some examples are shown here. So these are the Aquarius simulations done by the Virgo group. So these were high resolution simulations for a halo like the Milky Way halo. Okay, and so the right panel is showing the local slope of the density profile. And so you can see that at large radii, the density profile slope is very steep, something like r^-3. And that very, very slowly, very gradually towards smaller r, the slope just very gradually, smoothly rolls over to just to shallower and shallower slopes. So you can see also, you can also see that there's no scale picked out in this profile, right? Okay, you know, so the row, why is that happening?
That was me.
So there's no scale effect in this profile. And the vast majority of halos behave in this way, like I said. So the parameter that's most commonly quoted to describe the shapes of halos is the so-called halo concentration. Now the concentration basically is just measuring the extent of this outer steep part of the profile, it's just a measure of the range of radii for which the local slope is something very steep, like r^-3 or r^-2. At least for CDM-like cosmologies, the concentration has been seen to correlate well with other properties of halos, like for example the formation time. So that's shown here. So concentration is seen to be very high for old halos and to be low for young halos. We'll see the reason for this in a few moments. And that's it. So as I said, the vast majority of halos have this sort of basic NFW-like behavior. So because this behavior is so common and so generic, there's been lots of efforts undertaken to understand where this behavior is coming from. So for example, some of the early work suggested that perhaps the shape of the halo profile, so this halo profile shape might perhaps be coming from the shape of the matter power spectrum. And so to test this, you can try doing simulations that have different power spectrum shapes. And if you do so, what you'll find is that the halos that are formed in those cosmologies, those halos all have the same sort of NFW profiles. So the shape of the power spectrum turns out to be not important in setting interior structures of halos. Some later work then suggested that maybe substructure might somehow dynamically drive the interior profile towards something like NFW. And so to test that, you can try doing simulations of cosmologies where halos don't have substructure in them. So for example, for cosmologies like hot dark matter or warm dark matter, there's a cutoff scale in the power spectrum, and halos forming at that cutoff scale have no substructure in them. But nevertheless, those halos still have profiles that are very well fit by NFW. And some examples are shown here. So this is a recent paper by Simon White and his student Jia Wang. So they did simulations for a hot dark matter cosmology. They examined halos at the cutoff scale. So here are plots of the radial profiles of the halos along with the NFW fits. And these halos have profiles that are just as well fit by NFW as normal CDM halos are fit by NFW. So substructure, the shape of the power spectrum,
Just a cutoff in the power spectrum.
It's just a cutoff in the power spectrum.
So it's not really hot.
It's not really hot. That's right. That's a good point.
What happens with white noise?
So for n equals zero power spectrum. You still get normal NFW profiles.
With quite different concentrations.
So the formation history is probably somewhat different. Yeah, that's right. But this basic shape of the profile is preserved. Because the concentrations and the formation times are somewhat different. But they also have just NFW profiles. They do. So in general, hierarchical structure formation doesn't seem to be so important in setting the interior structures of these halos. So then what is important?
I mean, if you actually, you know, we all simulate.
Yeah.
So you're dealing here with a customer, white noise customer in the field.
Right.
But, you know, in ancient days, people did purely Poissonian calculations, which means that it had the whole hierarchy of Poissonian statistics.
Okay.
And it may be true, but it's just, it seemed a bit strange that it would be able to deal with such coherent structure from something which is so random. That, you know, it's really sort of random things that are bringing things together, and everything is uncorrelated in the two-point function, but all the higher point functions are delta functions.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I'd be a bit surprised, but maybe it's true.
So we've done simulations for these sort of...
No, but it requires certain assumptions about how things are falling in.
Well, essentially, if it's a nonlinear system, but it's chaotic, it'll erase all those initial conditions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But to get an order of magnitude.
That was my favorite. Yeah. Okay, okay, well, so you'll see the origin of the order of minus 3 in a few moments. Well, you've probably seen it already from talking to me. Okay, yeah, okay, so why is this happening? So we'll use these self-similar calculations as a guide. To ruin that joke. Okay, okay.
Go back.
You missed the joke.
Well, it wasn't really much of a joke anyway. So. Okay. So now we'll try to understand how self-similar collapse works. Okay, these next few slides will be pretty kind of hand-waving. So sorry in advance. So suppose that we have a peak of the initial linear density field. Okay, and suppose that locally at some radius r, the peak has some local slope gamma, such that locally the linear density is falling off with radius like r to the minus gamma. Okay. Now, as a function of time, at least at early times, this peak grows according to linear perturbation theory, which just says that that the shape of the peak is preserved in promoving coordinates as the amplitude grows according to the linear growth factor, which at the high ratios of interest just scales like the scale factor A. Okay. So as a function of time, the linear density in the peak just scales like A r to the minus gamma. Okay. Now, roughly speaking, so turnaround or collapse in the halo and in the peak, okay, the turnaround radius roughly scales, most roughly speaking, the radius that is falling into the halo is given by the scale for which the orbit density, the linear orbit density, becomes of order unity. Okay, so just by drawing on the line of delta of order unity, we can then easily read off the scales that are falling into the halo as a function of time. Okay, and you can see, so you can see very easily that the turnaround radius scales with time, like a to the 1 over gamma, where gamma was that original linear density slope. Okay, so you can see that the slope of the original profile tells you how fast scales are falling into the halo, which then tells you how fast the halo mass is growing in time. Okay, so for large gamma, when the slopes are very steep, the halo mass grows slowly in time, and for shallow profiles, when gamma is very small, the halo mass grows very quickly in time. Okay, so far this has all been in comoving coordinates, and of course in proper physical coordinates, the physical turnaround radius scales like the comoving radius times 1 more power of a. Okay, so the proper turnaround radius scales like a to the 1 plus 1 over gamma. Okay, now next, So while all this has been happening, in the background, the mean matter density has been falling off with time, like a to the minus 3, which I'll draw schematically here. Okay, and for these same times, we also work out these scales that are collapsing into the halo as a function of time. All right. Okay. So now I'll make one approximation, just for now. Okay. So let's pretend. Let's pretend that each shell just freezes at some fraction of its turnaround radius. Okay, just for now. Okay, So the reason for making this approximation, is that following turnaround, the shells fall into the halo. They start orbiting, right? most of the time in the orbit is spent near apoapsis, and generically, generically, apoapsis will be something of order of the turnaround radius. Okay, so that's the basic idea. And we'll be dropping that approximation in a moment. Okay, but if we make this simple frozen approximation, we can then easily work out the collapse profile just by looking at the distribution of these turnaround radii, right? Okay, so we have that rho goes like a to the minus 3, and above we have a relation between A and R. And so then combining the two, we can then see immediately that the slope of the collapse profile just scales like R to the minus 3 gamma over 1 plus gamma, okay, in the simple frozen model, okay? So you can see that the initial slope of the linear profile that determines the final slope of the collapsed halo profile in this frozen approximation. Okay. All right. So far I've just been focusing on the case of these scale-free initial profiles, but the same argument can be applied, more generally. Okay. So for example, suppose that we have a peak that has the following initial profile. Okay. Now this profile actually corresponds to the stacked average linear density profiles of the peaks that make low mass halos as taken from some of our N body simulations. Okay. You know, so this profile is actually fairly typical. Okay. You know, it's the average profile of peaks at low masses. Okay, so you can see that at a small radii, the slope is very shallow, and it rolls over to something very steep at larger radii. Okay. So for this kind of initial peak, that simple frozen model that I described, that's exactly right. Ah, stole my thunder. So for this peak, that simple frozen model would predict that the collapse halo would have the following shape, okay? So at small radii, because the initial slope is so shallow, gamma near 0, the final slope is also very shallow, slope near 0. And at large radii, because the slope is so steep, gamma approaching infinity, the final slope is also very steep, slope approaching r to the minus 3, okay? And minus 3 should, of course, ring a bell, right? And as we saw before, that the outer profiles of these NFW halos tend to have these steep r to the minus 3 outer profiles. And the reason for that here, just simply because the initial slope is getting so steep. And the reason why it's getting so steep is that here, this profile is changing sign, it's passing through 0. Right. Okay. So because we're looking at peaks of random fields, these sort of zero crossings will be commonplace. Okay. Okay. So now one point to emphasize is that the longer that this initial slope stays very steep like this, and the longer that the outer profile stays very steep, r to the minus 3. Or in other words, the higher the concentration of the halo is. Okay. All right. Okay. Next. What is the physical interpretation of a very steep initial profile? Right. Okay, so we saw before that the slope of the profile tells you how fast the halo mass is growing in time, right? So a shallow slope meant fast growth, a steep slope meant slow growth. And so an infinitely steep slope means that the growth is stopping altogether, right? And of course, the longer that this profile stays very steep, the longer the amount of time that passes while the halo is not growing, okay? Or the older that the halo is, right? Okay? So we can see that peaks that have these sort of very steep initial profiles will produce halos that are both old and that have high concentrations. Okay, so all these correlations that we saw before between concentration and formation history, and mass and that sort of thing. Okay, all those correlations, they're all very easy to understand. Okay, once you think about the properties of the peaks that the halos are coming from. I haven't mentioned that, but it's also easy to understand. Okay. Okay, so low mass halos tend to be what's called anti-biased, right? Okay. Right, they tend to reside inside of low density environments, right? Okay, because the small peaks living inside of high density environments tend to get either eaten by their neighbors or they grow into bigger halos, right? Okay. So because the average background densities for the low mass halos tend to be negative, they're much more common to have these sort of zero crossings. Right. Yeah. Which is why they tend to be much older. All right. Okay, so then skip some things. So this frozen model, you can see, so this frozen model predicts that the outer profiles of Halo will be steep, inner profiles are very shallow, with a sharp transition between the two behaviors. Okay? And of W halos, however, in contrast, in contrast, they have a much more gradual transition from the steep to shallow behavior. Okay? So there's several reasons for this. I don't have time, I think, to go through the whole argument. So let me instead just jump to some of the one of the more interesting or important points. So I'll jump here. So one of the important effects for the Halo profiles is adiabatic contraction. So here I'm plotting some of the orbits for a few of the particles that's taken from some of our calculations as a function of time. So red, green, and blue are just plotting x, y, and z for the particles as a function of time for a few different example orbits. Now in all the cases, you can see that the orbits are shrinking secularly over time. And the reason why this is happening is just simply, over time, the halo mass is growing. And so the potential experience by these orbits is getting deeper and deeper, and so in response, the orbits have to contract. This contraction, however, happens to be reasonably adiabatic. And that's shown in the bottom panels, which are somewhat hard to see, unfortunately. So these bottom panels are plotting the orbital actions as a function of time. Where the action is just defined as the integral of v dx, say for x, y, and z over orbit. Now these actions are not adiabatic invariants, as you can see. These actions are not perfectly conserved over time, right? That being said, so even though the orbital motions are shrinking secularly over time, the orbital actions are not shrinking secularly. They're oscillating, but the long-term average of the fluctuations averages out. So in that rough sense, these actions are roughly conserved. For the most part, there are some exceptions. So one example is shown here. So for the particles that get trapped into resonances, the contraction of the orbits can become highly non-adiabatic. As shown here, for example. This is just a movie to illustrate some of this orbital behavior. I think I'll skip this in the interest of time. So as new mass falls into the halo, the inner potential gets deeper and deeper, and so in response, the orbits have to contract. That contraction is roughly adiabatic. So it acts to hold fixed, roughly holding constant these orbital actions. And now the important point is that those same conserved orbital actions, those j, x, and j, y, j, z, they can also be predicted roughly from the initial linear density profile. So one example of that is shown here. So here's a plot of the x action as a function of the initial Lagrangian x coordinate of some particles. And for this potential, we would have expected this action to scale like the initial Lagrangian x squared, roughly speaking. And it does, as you can see. There is noise, right? Roughly speaking, at the sort of factor of two level, these actions can be predicted from the initial linear density profile. And so given these observations, we can then write down a really simple toy model to describe the internal structures of the halos. So the model has the following ingredients. So what we do is to first, so we take the initial linear profile, and we use that to determine the x, y, and z actions for all the orbits. Given the actions and given the potential, we can then estimate the sizes of all the orbits. Once we know the orbital sizes, we can then figure out the densities deposited by each orbit. And then by summing over all the different orbits, that then gives us the total density and therefore the total potential and closes the loop. So following this simple procedure, we can then solve for the self-consistent collapse profile for any given initial linear profile. And so some examples of this are shown here. So here I'm plotting a comparison between this trivial toy model and the full numerical calculations that we did. So the blue curves show the toy model, and the black curves show the full numerical 3D calculations. Okay, and so you can see, so you can see that over the range of radii that are virialized, the toy model works like surprisingly well.
Phase space sensitive is just this amazing OLOS.
No, it's not. Okay, it's yeah. Not. So the yeah. Okay, right. So the phase space sensitivity is not a power law. What is a power law is something something related to the entropy of the halo. Okay, it's funny. Rho over sigma cubed roughly scales like a power law for reasons that are not yet very clear. These also behave roughly in that way. But here, but here's the input profiles are also power laws. So it's not so surprising, that the animals get power laws. But in the full general case, it's not yet clear why this rho over sigma cubed feels like a power law.
Verging the subtraction laws in this case is already to be minus compensated, if I'm not wrong, or so.
Yeah, okay, so rho scales like R the, I guess, 3 gamma over 1 plus gamma, right? I guess sigma squared scales like M over R, like rho R squared. So I guess it is like R to the, so M over R, I know, so like R to the minus 3 over 1 plus gamma minus 1. And so by combining the two, this is all this is also just a power law, clearly. So there's nothing really deep about that in the Birchinger case. Excuse me?
The slope of the phase space sensitivity depends on gamma, that's what you're saying.
Yes, for the self-similar collapse, yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. And I believe that for n-body halos also, the slope varies from halo to halo. Is that not true?
I think the claim is that doesn't.
It doesn't.
I think this was a constant.
Okay. Well, for self-similar collapse, there's no reason that I can see why the gammas would cancel out. I mean, maybe if I do the algebra more correctly. As far as I can see, there's no reason in self-similar case why it would cancel out. This is not the phase-based sensitivity, of course, right? And you realize that, right? Yeah.
Can I just ask a quick question about this? So gamma is your assumed initial linear profile.
That's right.
And the ellipticity, the cube.
Yeah, the ellipticity.
Is it a shear ellipticity? Or
that's
a,
right.
It is the shear ellipticity.
It's the shear ellipticity. Yes. I learned from you, right? All right. So given the success of this simple model, we can try applying the same model for more general initial profiles. Last slide. That's shown here. All right. So the colored curves show the results of combining the simple profile. The simple toy model with the profiles of peaks expected for Gaussian random fields. Okay. So that's these color curves. And for comparison, these black curves show some of the commonly used fitting functions used in the literature. So dotted is NFW. The two dashed curves, these two dashed curves, they show the range of the NASO profiles that are commonly used to describe halos found in simulations. Okay, I should also mention that the range of radii that's possible to be simulated so far is about this big. Okay. So over the range of simulations, this very simple toy model agrees just shockingly well with the full n-body results. Okay. And so the important physics entering here was again just adiabatic contraction, basically. In our calculations, however, we have found no reason for the inner cusps to extend down to smaller radii. Okay. So our profiles instead just smoothly gradually roll over to shallower and shallower profiles towards r equals zero. Okay, but it takes them many, many orders of magnitude and radius to turn very shallow. Okay. Major mergers were not important in the end. So I'll stop here.
So one of the bits of physics that was missing from Fillmore and Goldreich was the radial orbit instability.
Ah, yes.
which can also take a pure spherical collapse and turn it into something prolate
Absolutely.
With an NFW profile.
No.
Something close to NFW-ish.
Yeah, actually, no, right? So Simon White had a paper recently looking at this. And so their profiles, they went over R squared for decades. You know, we've also looked at
in the outer part, I guess, but the inner part.
The virialized part. So down to the resolution limit, their profile stayed 1/r².
1/r² or 1/r?
1/r².
It's the Huss, Jane, and Steinmetz. I mean, this was ages ago.
Right.
It went right over to 1/r. I mean, the radial orbit instability.
Yeah. We've also looked at this, we found, for a spherically symmetric initial profile, if you allow the instability to recede, the final profile does eventually roll over to shallow 1/r², but it stays 1/r² for decades.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if I
recall correctly, it stayed 1/r² for about, I think, 2 decades in radius, which is not consistent with what we see in fractal and body halos. Yeah. And stability, though, isn't actually so important for most of these peaks, right? The ellipticities are strong enough initially.
Right.
It's not actually important. So only for the ellipticities less than like 0.05 or so. Was that important in the end with that?
Okay, I'm going to hold other questions because we are going to run a little late. But you'll be around for coffee and dinner, so feel free to find them then. Next, we've got